Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, July 10th. The governor just signed a bill into law to help nonprofits meet their bottom line, but could a legal challenge throw a monkey wrench in the process? A report about struggles following the Maui wildfires is being held out as evidence that FEMA has got to go. We get reaction from the report's author. The Big Island's Police Commission meets today to talk about whether its police chief gets to keep his job, why that became an issue when Honolulu's chief announced he was going to step down. We take off for a closer look at our airports. New Orleans is at the top of the list for best airport in the country. Hawaii's near the bottom. What can we learn? And to be or not to be, we check in on the lineup for the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The ink has barely had time to dry, but a bill signed into law by the governor less than 24 hours ago is raising some eyebrows. What's this about it possibly being unconstitutional? Here to talk about that is HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this is a bill that was supposed to help provide some money for nonprofits because, you know, a lot of their federal funding is getting cut. And this is in addition to the $30 million that they normally get through the grants and aid process, right?
That's correct. Yeah, they saw the need during the legislative session of all these nonprofits that were losing their federal funding and said, you know, we maybe need to do another tranche of grants. But they wanted to get it out as quickly as possible, which is why this bill is written, or this now law is now written so much differently than the regular grants and aid process, which happens during the legislative session. But the key difference is that the $50 million is being dispersed by a committee of four lawmakers, two senators and two representatives that are appointed by Senate President Kochi and then Speaker of the House, Nadine Nakamura. And those four lawmakers, two senators, two representatives, will make the decision on which organizations are going to get the funding. None of these meetings will be open to the public, and the bill exempts the committee from the Sunshine Law, which, you know, governs public meetings. And these provisions were inserted into the measure during conference committee, which is after all the public hearings on the bill were already closed. I spoke with several lawmakers who were concerned about this measure. One of them is Representative Della Abilotti. She's also the Public Safety Committee chair.
I've only become more and more concerned since May when we first passed this bill into law, because it directly contravenes the requirement in our state constitution that says that any legislative committee shall be open to the public. And we are creating this unusual process. I think people want to say it's normal, it's being efficient, but we cannot sacrifice the spending of taxpayers' monies with a process that is even potentially flawed. I think that the fact that they have a committee that's going to act in secret, even though they say that they're going to try to follow the 42F process in spirit, that doesn't reassure us of transparency and accountability and conflicts of interest.
Yeah, and that's the point, right? It's like this isn't past the test.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of concern about, you know, transparency, like why is this not like open in the public. You know, the 42F process that she's talking about is the law that governs how grants are selected. It is written in the law that they, the committee will apply all standards, conditions, and other applicable requirements under 42F. But Senator Troy Hashimoto, who did a bulk of the work on the bill in conference, says that, you know, the bill will follow 42F in spirit. You know, but Rep. Bilotti is concerned that this measure could just set a new standard at the legislature that could normalize this type of closed-door decision-making.
If it goes forward and becomes something that we commonly practice, can you imagine committees of four granting $50 million, $100 million just amongst themselves? That's not appropriate, and I think we need to spend taxpayers' monies more wisely and with more fidelity and more openness.
And, you know, she's not the only lawmaker that is concerned about this measure. House Representatives Kim Koko Iwamoto and Amy Peruso had similar concerns and urged for a special session in the coming months to make these awards through an expedited grants and aid process and even potentially increase the amount of funding available to nonprofits in need. And I want to make it clear that I don't think anybody is against the spirit of the bill, which is to give these nonprofits $50 million more dollars to fill the holes for federal funding. It's really about the process, I think, that they're concerned about mainly. And they're saying that we do have time because this legislature has put through like a couple of days over the next couple of months that they could come back for special session. Although Senate President Kochi did send out a press release about a month ago saying that they wouldn't be coming back. But those dates have been put out there to lawmakers from when they could come back. The House is also currently being sued over an advisory committee not having open meetings at the start of the legislative session. And that case is awaiting a judicial decision as well. You know, the lawyer representing the plaintiffs in that case, Lance Collins, also had constitutional concerns about this new law. He said it could be violating separation of powers where the legislature just can't unilaterally dictate where money is spent. They can appropriate the funds and then governor would then approve and release those funds. Collins says the way that this bill is written is that the committee could be violating it because it's telling Aloha United Way, who will be doing the administration of the funds, where to direct the money without governor's approval. Governor Josh Green, you know, heavily disagreed with these constitutional criticisms of the new law, even calling out, you know, former Democrat Senate lawmaker Gary Hauser directly, who wrote a blog post criticizing the bill.
I'm pretty darn tired of the haters out there. For example, Mr. Hauser, who sends out emails bashing the good work of senators and representatives when they're really trying to help people. There's some out there that will do anything, to rein on the real needs of people. And they suggest that it's a constitutional question, when in reality, it's just because they aren't getting their own time in the sunlight. When these good people are trying to actually bring $50 million to the organizations that struggle year in and year out, I find it very disturbing that we have that kind of perpetual drumbeat just attacking anything when good work is being done. And, you know, I think if we do see lawsuits against this bill, it would be pretty cynical because these $50 million are going to ultimately go to people who are hungry, people who are suffering from domestic violence, people who are losing their health care coverage, people who don't have a health center available to them. And so I know that people love to toss emails out and to try to create some controversy, but to tell you the truth, I won't have it. I think we have to help people, and I think it's very important that we call it for what it is, which is cynical, ugly behavior.
Well, I don't know. Some people say, well, does the ends justify the means? And, you know, you can see how people are a little nervous about potential corruption.
Yeah, I think that that's the issue. And, you know, there's really no timeline yet on when applications will be available or when the Legislative Selection Committee would be appointed. Although there are words of it could be Senator Troy Hashimoto, Representatives Daniel Holt and Chris Todd on that committee.
All right. Well, we'll have to see. Stay tuned. But thanks so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
We've been talking to HR's Ashley Mizuo. She was talking about a new law that will help Hawaii's nonprofits fill funding holes left by federal cuts.
We often advise people to follow their dreams. But what happens when that strategy doesn't work?
I had a hard time to motivate myself to do more. Like, I would stare at my computer screen in my cubicle, and I just would ask myself what the heck I'm doing.
How to respond when you stop loving your passions, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Pro Arts Playhouse in Kihei, Maui. With music and comedy, Eric Gilliam's White Hawaiian tells of his family and Hawaii's multi-ethnic culture. ProArtsMaui.org.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem made headlines yesterday when she claimed that 1 in 6 Maui fire survivors traded sexual favors for basic supplies. She said this yesterday at a meeting to decide if FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, should be eliminated. Take a listen.
The situation in Lahaina was so bad that 1 in 6 survivors were forced to trade sexual favors, other favors for just basic supplies. At the same time, illegal aliens were staying in luxury hotels using FEMA dollars. The Roosevelt Hotel is the one you're probably the most familiar with in New York City. They got to stay there for free on the taxpayer dime through this FEMA agency.
Noem was apparently referencing a report about Maui from May that was put out by the group Tugnawa. The Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration has previously used the report to claim that FEMA is rife with neglect and mismanagement. Kara Jabola-Carolis is one of the authors of the report, which focused on Maui's Filipino community in the aftermath of the 2023 wildfires. She told The Conversation's Maddie Bender that Noem and DHS are twisting the findings of her group's report.
The statistic that Kristi Noem referred to, either intentionally or unknowingly, actually spoke to immigrant women and Filipino women specifically who have been pressured and enforced by economic and coercion, essentially, into exchanging sex acts for basic needs post-disaster. So she was not sharing the information accurately because the 1 in 6 statistic refers specifically to immigrant and Filipino women, not to all women affected by the Lahaina fire.
And if we could talk about your group and your methodology of just putting that report together for a second. So how, with Tugnawa, did you foster that kind of environment where people felt comfortable sharing something really personal and vulnerable?
Sure. So Tugnawa is a different model of disaster response that's really about humanizing the people who are typically seen as these, you know, downtrodden recipients of aid on this like savior to survivor model where a savior is coming in from the outside, typically based on the Midwest and getting relief. Whereas Tugnawa is about community-based, data-based, and feedback-based disaster response, where people from the community and trusted leaders in the community are organized to respond to the disaster. And so the people who participated in that particular survey were identified through a member of their community who also went through and survived the Lahaina fire. So this is a different methodology than something maybe more traditional or extractive, where we're in it together. And after the research is done, it's tied to action. It's tied to solutions. And this report provided solutions straight from women who survived the line of fire, Filipino women, and also diversity of experts on Maui, whether they're in the judiciary or law enforcement or mental health or gender-based violence. So this report really does speak to what the local community wants. And if Kristi Noem actually cares about that, then she would be proposing more funding for FEMA.
It must have been an interesting experience when this report was released a few months back. It got a lot of media attention. So what do you think is missing from the conversation, or what do you think officials who definitely have seen the report might be getting wrong about it?
Well, first and foremost, the Department of Homeland Security is the biggest threat to immigrant women's safety, period. So if there's any institution that needs to be defunded and dismantled, it would be the Department of Homeland Security. It acts as a second abuser or an accomplice to abusive partners, exploiters, in that it keeps women trapped in those abusive situations because they are too afraid to seek help from law enforcement and even from mental health professionals and healthcare professionals who they view as authorities or people who may even collaborate with the state and with DHS against them. So I think that's misunderstanding number one, is that the Department of Homeland Security and this aggressive escalation of forced removal and the siege on immigrant communities is actually going to drive women deeper into violence. So having that particular agency try to co-opt the report is a total absurdity. That's my reaction, is that it's very, very clear who is actually posing a threat to immigrant women in this political moment.
And thinking about the potential dismantling of an agency like FEMA, what would that mean to the Maui community in Lahaina, and then also specifically the immigrant communities that you were focused on in your report?
Well, we're seeing catastrophic wildfires spreading across the entire globe, across the United States, and also across Hawaii. Just, you know, within the last week, how many wildfires erupted in Nanakuli on West Oahu. So any dismantling to the federal government's response to environmental disasters is a threat to our communities in terms of funding, in terms of infrastructure. And we know that it's also part of just a broader dismantling of the federal government and anything that has to do with supporting women. Using our report to claim that, you know, the administration cares for women and is doing this out of compassion and concern for women is not backed by the rest of its actions, banning any research that contains terms like women, race, or inclusivity is happening at the same time that they're quoting our research on women. You know, dismantling the Department of Labor's Bureau, Women's Bureau, proposing to defund that agency, completely dismantling and abolishing Women, Peace, and Security, which is the gender infrastructure across from the across the Department of Defense, also just happened on top of all of the attacks on women's health and reproductive rights. So all of these things really undermine the assertion that Christino made that they need to dismantle or defund FEMA because it will help our community somehow.
Is there anything else that you want listeners in Hawaii to know about this moment or this report?
Yeah, there is something that I hope that the public knows, and that this report is actually receiving just as much positive attention and momentum statewide. So the state is taking action. You know, Representative Della Albalotti is taking action to assist in developing a statewide disaster plan for women. Organizations like the Philippine Consulate, the Filipino Community Center, Tugnawa on Maui, Hawaii Community Foundation, Maui County, all of these groups are activated and working to build a plan for Hawaii, regardless of what is happening with the Trump administration. And so there's just this outpouring of support and action around the report that I think people should know about, that I'm very heartened by.
That was Kara Jabola Karolis of the group Tugnawa for Maui. She spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender about her organization's report, which was referenced yesterday by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. Underway now in Hilo, a meeting of the police commission on the island of Hawaii. Members are taking up the future of Big Island Police Chief Ben Moskowitz. It's fallout triggered by the sudden resignation of Honolulu Police Chief Joe Logan. Here to talk about this is HPR's Mark Liddell. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so this came about because of this resignation and a conversation that Mr. Moskowitz had with Mayor Blangiardi. And some say that the mayor may have overstepped his authority by asking him to, you know, become the new interim police chief.
Right. And like you it said, that triggered this fallout where the Chief Moskowitz wanted to withdraw his resignation. And on June 20, when the Big Island Police Commission had its meeting last, they barely voted to keep him in. to stay as the police chief, but they also voted to have another meeting where they're going to talk with the chief about why he did what he did, and they're going to be able to ask him questions and listen to testimony. And that's the meeting that's going on, likely right now. It started at 10 a.m. And at the end of the meeting, as part of the agenda, they're also going to be able to decide whether or not to accept Moskowitz's withdrawal of his resignation. It's likely to be kind of a charged meeting. And there's going to be a lot of opinions, a lot of questions that'll be asked. I was able to get in touch with some of the commissioners before the meeting. That includes Commissioner Wendy Botello. She said she hopes the commissioners, this is what she highlighted, she hopes the commissioners make their decisions on this based on what their constituents want, rather than their own personal feelings. And what she had told me was that most of the people that she's been talking to, they want Moskowitz out.
I think it's so important that we need to really think about and consider that, the constituents' points of view, because we're not sitting on the commission for our own personal point of view. That is definitely not where I come from about my personal view. For me, it's the view of the people that we represent. A lot of the constituents that I have been talking to seem to not want Chief Ben to return to office. So it's what I'm hearing. So it seems to be pretty consistent.
Yeah, and I should mention that Botello was one of the four commissioners who voted to kick Moskowitz out in that June 20 meeting. And she said that, she had some praise for the police chief, but she didn't really like how he went about things. And I think that's kind of the bigger concern with the community.
He jumped the gun.
Yeah. And now she's saying that the community feels like he's more career oriented and sort of self-serving instead of prioritizing the well-being of the Big Island residents. So
that's, he doesn't care. Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
you get it.
Yeah, so that's understandable. She was also concerned because he didn't do any consulting or talk to the commission at all. It came as a surprise to them. When I talked to the chair of the commission, Rick Robinson, he was a little more upset with Mayor Blangiardi, and he, at some point he had mentioned that he would have liked a letter of apology from Blangiardi for being so involved and kind of facilitating this. That's kind of what's going on the Big Island. Meanwhile, it's also caused issues on Oahu with the Honolulu Police Department and its own commission. The mayor said that he wanted to, he wants a little more power. His office wants more power to choose who the police chief on Oahu is. And the police commission on Oahu, they were a little more, they're open to that too. So and this leads into some of the reporting that I did this week. I was talking to some folks about, what would be better, who would be better to have that ability to hire and fire the chief. The folks that I talked to, they wanted the commission to have more power to provide oversight more generally and maybe have somebody else choose the police chief, but they weren't necessarily so interested in the mayor having that ability. One of the groups I talked to was Common Cause Hawaii, and I talked specifically to Cameron Hurt, and he discussed sort of his opinion about it.
We are really a country of three equal branches of government. And those branches do not just exist, and they are not just intended to exist on a federal level. They exist on a local level. The city council should have way more insight, way more of a say, and way more control and leverage over the commission than they do. As the commission being a semi-legislative entity themselves, they should be overseen by the highest legislative body in the city, and that should be the city council. So for me, I'd move it to the city council's jurisdiction.
Yeah, so there's all this discussion about should it be the police commission or the mayor, and then some folks are saying it should be neither. Maybe it should be the Honolulu city council. So it's interesting about like who should have these powers. And like that's a discussion that's going to be going forward. I should say that all of these changes can go into or can be made through the changes in the city charter. And the last time the police commission was on a charter question, which voters vote on, they wanted to give the police commission more powers, not less.
All right. Okay. So there's another one. Stay tuned.
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much, Mark. We've been talking to Deshra's Mark Liddell, who's been looking into the police chief flap here in Honolulu and on the Big Island.
For communities near oil refineries, drill, baby, drill really means something.
My dad worked at Chevron for 20 plus years. And, you know, my dad always told me growing up, mijo, don't do what I do. So I'm doing the complete opposite of what he...
I'm Kai Rizdahl, environmental justice versus the economy. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
New Orleans has been voted best airport in the U.S. 4 years in a row by travelers in recent customer satisfaction surveys. In contrast, Hawaii has been at the bottom, though recently it moved up in the rankings slightly. So on a trip to the Big Easy, my first time there, I talked to visitors and residents about travelers' first impressions and what they think makes the NOLA airport, the New Orleans, Louisiana airport, stand out. Here's the welcome that I heard stepping off my plane.
Hi, I'm Latoya Cantrell, Mayor of the City of New Orleans. Welcome to the new Louis Armstrong New Orleans International Airport.
You know, I talked to a number of people, and one of them was Chantel, a Louisiana resident who works in an airport shop. She told me she knows the secret of its success.
First of all, we treat everybody like family. That's number one. You treat everybody with kindness, with love, and with respect. Number two, it's the food, baby. You can't go wrong with the food. Food is made out of love. Number three, it's just spending quality time. We're not fast paced, but we're here. And that's what makes New Orleans number one.
Well, it's this airport in particular. And I don't know. I mean, I just stepped off an airplane. I've never been here before. But like I said, I'm intrigued at what your success is due to, because Hawaii's at the bottom.
I wouldn't know why y'all at the bottom, to be honest. I tell you, do that hula dance, give them a little ribbon, and just dancing is the thing. And y'all gonna get there. Don't worry. You make one person smile, you did your job for the day. You definitely did your job.
And Heidi, another Louisiana resident, had this to say.
My name is Heidi, and I think people enjoy flying in and out of the New Orleans airport just because it's very efficient, moving in and out. Is done quickly, and the facilities are well kept and clean.
And then as far as just the sheer traffic, I mean, there's a lot of people in this airport, but it just seems like the security lines go fast.
Yes, ma'am, they're very good about keeping the lines flowing and moving as quickly as possible, but also keeping safety measures in check.
And then I hear the food's pretty good.
Yes, anywhere in South Louisiana where you're going to eat, the food's going to be delicious, full of flavor. Lots of food and shopping options within the airport to kill time while waiting for your flight.
And people seem to be pretty helpful.
Yeah, Southern hospitality.
And good signage, too.
Yes, everything's very lit up and clear and makes it very easy to navigate through.
Another frequent traveler to New Orleans offered this point of view.
Hi, I'm Roland Moore from Oakland, California, and I think it's a one-word answer, food. Restaurants are plentiful in this airport. It was expanded a few years back, and there's lots of room for people and food. And as I walked from my gate out to the front of the airport, I smelled all kinds of good smells, including some really rich sausages. So I think that's it, pretty much. The way to a traveler's heart is through his or her stomach, right?
Compared to other airports you've been to?
Well, you mentioned you're from Hawaii, and I have to say I love the outdoor character of Honolulu's airport. It's just spectacular, and it's the envy of lots of other airports as far as I'm concerned. But I'm a fan of the smaller airports in California where I'm from. For example, my hometown, Oakland Airport or Santa Barbara or Long Beach or Burbank, those are a lot easier to navigate than the big ones like LAX or SFO.
Comfort, easy to navigate.
That's right. And another thing that's really important is transit connections. We're waiting for a bus from the airport to downtown New Orleans, and we've been waiting a while, whereas at both Oakland's airport and San Francisco's airport, you can hop right on a BART and get into the city easily.
Something to consider. Well, we're going to get rail soon.
Oh, excellent. I look forward to that as a periodic visitor to Hawaii, so can't wait to take it.
And back here on the ground in Honolulu, we asked the state's transportation director, Ed Sniffen, about Hawaii's standings in the rankings and how we were doing with the needed improvements to our airports. Hawaii is spending nearly $2 million to overhaul our facilities. As part of the modernization plan, millions have been spent to upgrade our runways and taxiways, which are critical to operations. The Daniel K. Inouye International Airport in Honolulu has a new car rental facility, and there have been upgrades to bathrooms and other areas of the terminals. The facility had been previously ranked second from the bottom nationally. Maui is also ranked low as a middle-sized airport. But Sniffen says the state is chipping away at the upgrades. The difference between New Orleans and Honolulu is Louisiana was able to build a new facility right next to the old terminal. In a way, it's not so easy renovating what's already there. Sniffen agrees New Orleans Airport does rock.
I love the airport. Big high ceilings, big open spaces, really good food options throughout, which is what we're trying to get to. When we built our Mauka Conquest, we made sure that we built a new feel to things. That's why you see it so airy and so big and so bright. We're adding in the food choices into that area now, and we're working really closely with hosts to make sure that nobody has to go too far to get their food options. But when we did that, when we built Mauka Conquest, it made the Alpha Gates and Bravo Gates look really shoddy because we have those low ceilings and darker areas. We spent a lot of time and resources internally to make sure that we could brighten that area up, make sure that we can bring more color to the space. We know we can't build it higher today, but we can make it as clean as possible, and we can make sure that we can bring the color and the feel from the islands. And this way, when you walk through those alpha gates, you can see now the readjustments we've made. We're making sure that we look at that Terminal 2 area, those E gates and F gates, and refreshing those as well. We're going to be putting about $60 million into that. Make sure we can refresh those spaces, the storefronts, the carpeting, all those pieces, fully understanding that very soon we're going to be building out that $1.2 billion to $1.5 billion Diamond Head concourse. Last thing we want is for Diamond Head to come up to make the other gates look shoddy too. So we're going to be advancing our improvements in those areas. While we're making sure we advance the improvements for aesthetics, we're also increasing our food options throughout. What we didn't like when we came in is that the restaurants that you find in the building just didn't reflect our local feel. We reset our restaurant, a couple of our restaurants, now to Panda. So that's something that feels good to locals, which is a good thing. We're bringing in MW restaurants. They're going to be taking over that Torrent Basil area in 2026. Lace Dan's coming through to make sure that we get that island bar feel as well. Alan Wong is going to come in. He's going to take over that restaurant in the central concourse area. I think Island Plate's coming in, that's Lanai's group, to make sure that we can get those plate lunches coming through so that we can share out that local feel with everybody, but also have the comfort food for our locals here. As part of those concepts, we're looking at trying to see how we get more malasadas that people can grab to take as omiyage when they're going traveling. All of those pieces are going to make it a lot more comfortable for everybody to come to the airport, get what they need, get the foods that they like, and get to the areas that they want to rest in at the hold rooms. All hold rooms are going to be upgraded as well.
What about just the efficiency of security, you know, TSA, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. So we've worked really closely with TSA to make sure that we can upgrade their service. As everybody goes through those lines, they can see that, in general, our lines are less than 20 minutes long. And I give a lot of credit to TSA. So we've been tracking the lines throughout. Our VIP staff has been making sure we monitor the time frame it takes for a person to get through those areas. Once it starts getting up to 20 minutes, we make sure we let TSA know, and they send more resources, either to open more gates or open another checkpoint, to ensure that we can minimize that wait. I don't know if the public has seen so far, but we've started putting up in our Malka concourse, our Malka gates, times to get through checkpoints. So everybody understands. You walk over here and you get into this line, it's going to take this long. We're going to start putting them up in the Terminal 2 areas as well. So you can start seeing, if I go through this checkpoint, it'll take this long. Or I can walk 5 minutes to this other checkpoint and take this long. And you get choices from there. Then once we get them all set up, we'll start putting it online. So everybody understands, you have these many parking stalls available in the inter-island or international parking area. You have this long to wait during your checkpoints. So you can start planning out your day as you get to the airport.
So hopefully that will make for a more pleasant experience and less stress all around.
Absolutely. And tied to that is our wayfinding apps. So we started setting up an app to ensure that once you get to the airport, you click on that app, you open it up, it'll tell you where you are, and you can let them know where you need to go. It'll give you that map to get through those areas. We're also trying to tie to the restaurants to ensure that you can start ordering too. So while you're waiting to get to your checkpoint, in that 20-minute time frame, you could order your food from a different restaurant, go in there, pick it up, and be ready to just hang out at your hold room there.
Those apps are available now?
Yes, they're available now. We'll start pushing out more information to the public so we can advertise where you can get it.
And then what about for Maui? Because I know for mid-sized airports, that's on the bottom of the list too. But you have made some headway there.
Oh, hugely, hugely. So on the J.D. Power reports, we moved up 2 spots already on both. And they see the work that we put into it. We were hit in the past with security checkpoint times, lack of food options. So we made sure we've put a lot of resources into addressing those. For Maui, we put a lot of money, I think $80 million into the hold rooms into that space. Beautiful space. Putting another $70 million into the checkpoint over there. So another 6 lines are coming in very soon. We started up the construction for that project already. Once those 6 lanes are set, we'll go back to the original 7 and start refurbishing them. The biggest thing for us is that TSA equipment has to be air-conditioned, climate controlled, to make sure we can last as long as possible. So we'll start hitting that area, making sure we turn it into a climate-controlled area, a lot more comfortable for everybody going through those zones. And once that's done, we'll have 13 lanes at Maui to make sure that we don't have those backups that we had in the past.
So there you have it. Some of the things on the wish list, Mala Sadas and Alan Wong's and plate lunches. You know, New Orleans has a program to hire jazz musicians to entertain passengers. We asked the DOT about that, and they say the Hawaii Tourism Authority has something in place with Hawaiian Mele in Hula, though it's in targeted areas. And remember that message from the mayor of the city of New Orleans? Well, stay tuned. A message from the governor is in the works.
Together, New York, we're going to freeze the...
Zoran Mamdani handily won New York City's Democratic mayoral primary. He's a self-declared Democratic socialist with a populist platform, and that's making other Democrats across the country nervous. Populism and the Democratic Party, that's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
On the next Living on Earth, 22 youth plaintiffs sue the federal government over its drill baby drill agenda.
By implementing these executive orders, our president is harming us, but we are doing something about it, and we are going to challenge that, and we aren't going to quit.
I'm Jenny Doring, Lighthizer v. Trump, next time on Living on Earth from PRX.
Beginning this evening at 7.
You know, we're told the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival has presented every Shakespeare play in the canon and is back for its 25th year. Our Kevin Garcia-Dole is the artistic director of the festival. He's also directed one of the this summer's productions. He spoke with HPR's D.W. Gibson about what theatergoers can expect from the two upcoming shows, a return to two fan favorites.
This year, we're doing Hamlet and Comedy of Errors. We haven't done Hamlet as part of the regular season, though, since the very first season. Ihelani Cho, the woman who's directing it, is absolutely the right person for that right now. And I've worked on a couple of productions of Comedy of Errors, and I think part of what's attracted the board to this production was I have a strange concept that it's touring company that's come in to perform Comedy of Errors, and within the first 5 minutes of the show, the actor who's been advertised as the lead actor loudly quits off stage, and the rest of the cast then spends the rest of the show trying to keep the show going despite the fact that the main actor is gone.
Well, and it seems like this summer you're really running the gambit here, sort of the highs of yeah. Comedy of Errors and the depths of despair with Hamlet.
Yes. And, you know, and that's also deliberate. Audiences internationally tend to flock towards the comedies, but the great name tragedies are considered great for a reason. I mean, they really have been some of the most influential plays or literary works, period, in Western history. And, you know, I love Hamlet. Hamlet's one of my all-time favorite plays. There's so much that I think it says about humanity that was true then that is still true now.
And it looked like some dynamic casting there too.
Yeah, the Shakespeare Festival has a long history of color conscious, gender conscious casting. So we, generally speaking, are willing to cast anyone who seems to be right for the part, regardless of age, appearance, gender, ethnic background. And that's been something that I think has been really important to us as a festival. So both Comedy of Errors and Hamlet have a very diverse cast. Hamlet in particular, Ihelani, when she approached Hamlet, wanted to approach it as a genderqueer production. And she specifically has eliminated a lot of the gendered pronouns and gendered language in Hamlet. So King Claudius is Queen Claudia in this production, for example, still marries Hamlet's mother. The basic dynamic is still there. But beyond the casting, she's exploring a lot of the idea that the veil between the supernatural and the natural world is weakening over the course of the show. And I think while she was casting, both of those things were very heavily on her mind. I was going more with the idea for Comedy of Errors that it was a company that had been cast by this fictional actor that quits. And part of the reason everyone ends up playing everything is out of just sheer necessity. You know, actors are superheroes. But despite the saying the show must go on, sometimes the show goes on without you. That's sort of the subtext of this one, is that, you know, the actors are going to make it work no matter what. And that's been my experience with actors every time I've directed. Actors will get out there, they will make it work.
Well, I feel like with these two shows in particular, they're really burdened by history. They're well-known shows in different ways. And there are so many well-known performances, especially with Hamlet over the years. So carving out your own space with Hamlet, carving your own space out with Comedy of Errors, which has inspired so many farces across time.
Yeah. I do think that's something that we generally think about when we're producing all of the shows at the festival. We do try to think about a little bit about how we can leave our stamp on it, but I think a lot of that actually comes from the directors thinking, how can I best communicate the themes and ideas of this play to a contemporary audience? You know, so I think that's really central to what we do. So we are interpreting the plays, but, you know, anytime anyone reads anything, they are putting their own images on everything in it, right? You know, you're putting a specific face on a character. And I think that the great thing about being able to direct Shakespeare is you can take some of those ideas you have in your head and highlight them, foreground them. You know, one of the things we're really trying to foreground in Comedy of Errors is this idea that the confusion that's going on is both on and off stage, and that even though life might throw wrenches at you, you can still work your way through it. And, you know, while I'm hardly making an enormous political point with it, it is very important to me to, at this particular time in history, to let people feel like, yeah, we can get through something. We can get, it might, life might be sending a lot of rough stuff to us these days, but we can get through it. We just have to support each other, work together, and we will survive and hopefully thrive on the way through it.
This is part of the magic of theater, right? This sort of dualistic experience you can have where you can escape for a couple of hours in a dark space, but also have the world you're living in reflected back to you in some ways.
Yeah, and that's one of the really fabulous things about studying Shakespeare and really getting into the nitty-gritty of it is that the characters that you see in his plays are very familiar to us because, you know, he was writing about rulers that went, you know, kind of off the deep end and about people dealing with their daily confusions and about people falling in love with people who aren't interested or people falling in love and they are interested, but they can't get together. These are all things that we still experience every day to this day. Almost any archetype we encounter, they're in there. Yeah, they might speak in a slightly more elevated language than we speak, but those characters still exist. So in some ways, it's reassuring, even if you're watching a play like, for example, King Lear with the tyrannical ruler who is starting to go through phases of dementia and lashing out at everybody and making terrible choices, looking at that and saying, all right, that existed 400 years ago and the world got through it.
You know, there is this elevated language that comes with Shakespeare, and I think that's the first thing that comes to people's mind when they think about Shakespeare. But he does have these moments, particularly in both of these shows, where you don't have elevated language. We have commoners speak where it's not iambic pentameter, where it's free verse and it's sort of more visceral.
Yeah, absolutely. That was part of how he wrote. He wrote for all levels of society. So there's absolutely some stuff that is just, you know, the rough language that people would have been speaking in the late 16th, early 17th century. And I think that's really fun. Some of the best stuff in both of the plays is just as funny now as it would have been presumably 400 years ago. And there's something really cool about that when, you know, you have the scene with one of the sisters being in Comedy of Errors being pursued by who she thinks is her sister's husband, but is really an identical twin that has stumbled upon this city. And her both being stunned at his pursuit, but also like kind of charmed with his pursuit in a way that she's not comfortable with. The comedy in that sequence really lands because we in the audience know exactly what's going on. We know that there's that confusion. And so everything she says still kind of hits to this day because the situations are so strong. So you're absolutely right. There's a lot of prose language in the plays that absolutely still just clicks like you could have heard it on the street. Terry Knapp, who was Hawaii's great Shakespeare teacher and actor, both at the university, and he's the one that the play is dedicated to. And one of the things he championed was the idea that the rhythm of pidgin really aligns very closely with the rhythm of all of Shakespeare, but especially the characters that speak more in prose. Part of why I think a lot of Shakespeare really works better in Hawaii than a lot of places in the world is some of the rhythm and the feeling of the language just feels very familiar in a way that it might not if you're in Vermont or Des Moines.
That's fascinating. I feel like a lot of contemporary theater is designed to be, let's say, more affordable to produce.
Yeah.
And that often includes small casts, but Shakespeare is not really a fan of the small cast thing. So talk about the experience of bringing together such a large ensemble and getting them all to work well together.
I'm Gen X. And one of the things about being theater educated in my generation was we still had a lot of the old guard directors. I remember in the 90s, I had a director, we were working on a play with him, and he got angry at something one of the actors on stage said, and he hurled a chair at them. Yeah. And we were all like, oh, well, he's a genius. Of course he can do that. And, you know, I think one of the really remarkable things that has happened in the last 15, 20 years is the younger generation of actors saying, no, that's not how we should work. We shouldn't be doing this, this top-down way of creating theater. The original director, the first person in the Western world who's considered a director, is a German duke who is literally directing his peasants. Yeah. And to some extent, that kind of dynamic of noble or royalty as director and peasants as the actors, that dynamic has kind of continued down over the years. But again, in the last 15 to 20 years, things have flattened out. A lot of that comes from just a greater recognition that, you know, the people that are working are all humans. Everyone deserves respect. Everyone deserves to have their boundaries respected, their talents respected, their ideas respected. And honestly, seeing it all in my 50s now, I look back at how we used to do things and I'm like, that was awful. You know, why did we put up with any of that? So I really feel like company building starts from a place of, we want to hear you all. We want to acknowledge that there's a little bit of a power imbalance that is inherent in any situation where one person is directing and other people are acting. But we also want to respect that. If you guys have great ideas, we want to make that part of the show. My personal philosophy has always been, I don't care if the idea that the audience sees on stage is my idea. I care that it's a good idea. That, I think, is at the heart of getting a really solid group of people working together effectively. And I feel like when we do that well, we create these really tight-knit groups of people who are really invested in the show, invested in each other, and are able to work extremely well together. I mean, the joke we make is there's a scene in The Blues Brothers where Dan Aykroyd throws a shrimp into John Belushi's mouth, and it looks like they weren't even looking at each other when they did that. And in a metaphorical way, we're tossing shrimp into each other's mouths because they're just all so in tune with each other. So yeah, I mean, with a big company, it really comes down to everybody buying into a culture of respect with each other.
Yeah, that respect and that sense of trust, right? And that sense of freedom. You're not going to express an idea unless you feel like there are circumstances under which you can express that idea and have it be received.
Yes, exactly. You have to create that environment. That environment doesn't just spring up.
Well, so tell us about the productions and where we can see them, because I know that the festival works with a couple of different venues.
Yeah. This year, Comedy of Errors is going to be in the Arts at Mark's Garage. The Arts has been a partner with Hawaii Shakespeare Festival for over 20 years, but we got really lucky that Manoa Valley Theater has been interested in collaborating with us, and so Hamlet is going to be performed at Manoa Valley Theater. And we're really excited about it. The Manoa Valley Theater space is a terrific place to perform in. Getting to do one of the great Shakespeare plays on this terrific stage is really exciting to us.
Well, so we have Comedy of Errors in July and Hamlet in August.
That's exactly right. Yes.
Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight. Well, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was our Kevin Garcia Doyle talking with HBR's D.W. Gibson about the Hawaii Shakespeare Festival, which kicks off this Friday. For more information about showtimes and tickets, visit our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show planned for you. There's been lots of drama circling around the Hawaii Tourism Authority. We've collected recent interviews about the agency's past and future as it gets revamped in the months to come. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something you heard? You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.